at Seattle U ran out, I think.
Yeah, universities. So Aisha, are we ready or not quite?
Looks like she walked out. They're doing foot care and all that other stuff that's just basic.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing it. I couldn't hear you.
Yeah, it was doing that this morning too after being fine before this session and being fine right before this session as well.
Oh, that's okay. So as long as I was just asking, are we ready?
Yes, we are recording on the camera. And
okay, so we can just go.
Oh, no, yeah. This all right. Is all on tape.
Yeah, that gets cut. Don't worry, I clean it.
How many times has that been said?
I clean it up. Yeah, yeah. I don't use that.
Anyway, well, thanks again. This is, it wasn't even in my wheelhouse that it was happening, and I'm always kind of 50-50 about even doing anything anymore. But like I said, I can't get in any more trouble, so.
Thanks. All right, so it is Friday, beautiful Friday, October 6, 2023. And I'm Josephine Ensign here with the Reverend. Do you prefer Reverend? Well, I'll just call you Reverend.
Mostly when I'm wearing my collar to be introduced, but after that you can call me Bill.
Okay, yeah. So the Reverend Bill Curlin Hackett, and he is the director of the Interfaith Task Force on Homelessness and longtime working in vehicle residency. So thanks for being here. And as you know, this is a project about the history and current situation of homelessness in Seattle and the King County area. So tell me a little bit about what led you to this work and what you're doing now.
Sure. I fell into it. My wife and I had moved here from California. We were in a church together as clergy that was populated by the Hatfields and the McCoys, and they caught up with us. And it took a while to get reestablished, but once I did, I saw an invitation to an event at St. Mark's Cathedral in 2001, and it was being put on by a group of community activists, one of whom was David Bloom, who was at the church council still, I think, then, or had previously just left it, I think. And it was the dean, Robert Taylor, was asking, why do we have no corporate or collective effort to end homelessness? 1073 was at the cathedral at the time. So they put on this event. 350 people came. The mayor of Seattle, Gil Kerlikowske, was still the police chief. He came. A bunch of religious leaders came. And the afternoon was spent with an action plan. And the first thing out of the action plan was to create the Interfaith Task Force on Homelessness because they wanted the faith community especially to find its voice. And there was a draft of a statement that all the religious leaders signed that day saying we need to end homelessness. The second thing they did was they started the ball rolling on the first 10-year plan. And within a year or less, they started having those meetings with people like Blake Nordstrom and Dan Brettner of Car Toys and others, as well as leaders from the cities. So it took them till 2004 to write the plan, and then 2005 it was laid out. In the meantime, I was going around with David Bloom to county staff and to everybody we'd go to find out what's behind this problem of not having enough of a response to homelessness. We had some wonderful King County staff teach us things. I wrote them on the back of my pad. They're still there. And we started going to council meetings of the King County Council. I testified at the Seattle City Council, first time I'd ever done that in my life, to testify at a city council. And even without knowing what we were really there for in terms of a particular piece of legislation, we were there to bring light to the vulnerable because it wasn't there right now. The region had people like Cher and Wheel had already started. There were some fledgling encampments that had already started and been swept away. So it wasn't that it was brand new to the region. It's just that it wasn't coherent and it wasn't anything collective. And so I did a lot of personal learning along with David. We had task force meetings. We brought together a lot of good advocates. We were aimed at education and advocacy. So we formed groups in East King and South King as well, and we would travel down there. And we're looking at this regionally for King County. Seattle was still the centerpiece. I was living in Redmond at the time, and there wasn't a lot of homelessness over in Redmond that we could see.
Visible, right.
Yeah. And so it was a time of learning, but also teaching. A lot of the things that I've written about and that I've come to use were things I learned right away.
And so teaching, sorry to interrupt, but teaching the general public, the congregations, the elected officials, or all of the above?
A lot of it. For example, faith communities had no idea what their rights are. It took until 2019 to get a bill passed in the state legislature that guarantees faith communities their federal rights to host the homeless. We were just learning about it those early years, and I got appointed by Ron Sims to the Citizens Advisory Commission on Homeless Encampments, which was for Tent City 4 mostly, rotating on the east side, and all the jurisdictions were trying to pass their own ordinances. So King County formed this group. Every council member from the King County Council recommended two people, and we met for months and ended up drafting the first ordinance for King County on how to host the homeless. Mm-hmm. And it was at a faith community, pretty much. Every city still went and did its own.
Of course.
And we spent a lot of time going to the cities. And for example, Bellevue spent $500,000 trying to block any ordinance from happening and block any tent city from locating in the city. So it was hard back then. You know, Scott Morrow and the people who were at Tent City 4, and some of the people in the faith community, like Father Larry out in Bothell, St. Brendan's, were very strong about holding their ground.
Mm-hmm.
And they would often sit in the front of a community meeting and listen to abuse being yelled and just tell people what they were there for, the safe place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those proceeded okay. I know there were a few meetings I led where people charged the podium. And other members of the audience got up and stopped them. It was – people were vitriolic about it. You would have thought we were bringing aliens or terrorists or armed guerrillas to the neighborhood. And so it was a hard time, and jurisdictions couldn't get their head around not being able to permit faith communities. In fact, that was what they kept thinking all the way through 2010 when we had the first bill go through. That bill wasn't strong enough. It happened because of Lacey, city of Lacey. And what they were saying was, you can have a tent city at your church as long as it's indoors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It can't be visible outside.
Can't be visible, mm-hmm. right? So it was 2019 before we got the bill that currently exists right now. And but so the education part has been, in some regard, helping other people understand who the homeless are, that the preponderance of homeless people are like us,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, 20-25% might have mental health issues. Another 10% might have slightly less mental health issues. Another 10-15 to could be 20% have issues with substances. A lot of them are just not out there for any reason other than economic hardship and mistakes they've made, which we all make. And teaching people that they all make mistakes is a big one.
We don't like to admit it.
We don't not only not like to admit it, we want to make sure we get you on your mistakes and we don't allow you to escape them. And that's in part what's going on right now. There's a rebound of punitive behavior. I'm putting together this next little book aiming at faith communities, but in part, I'm basing the theme on something I came up with after the book I wrote, which is kind of four stages, and they all intermingle of what's going on for homeless: isolation. And that's a medical issue right now for non-homeless people. Mm-hmm. It's an enormous issue in our country. But then the second one was stigmatization, which we saw a terrible amount of in the early 2000s, but it still happens. If you're homeless, you're different than those of us who are
housed. And forever, you're different.
Yeah. And then criminalization, which we're seeing rebound through jurisdictions. And then finally, abandonment. And that's the worst one. We saw so many people who had just given up hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't even know what they wanted to do. When we were doing vehicle outreach, we would go ask, well, just out of these three things, what would you like? Would you like to be in a tiny home? Would you like to live in your RV in a safe lot someplace like a mobile home park? or do you want to be put straight into housing? Just those three choices. People had a hard time saying which one it was they wanted, because to say I wanted to go into housing, they look at that pathway and think, well, that's like climbing a mountain with no path mm-hmm. and nothing but boulders, because they know the system enough to know what's not going to work. So the hard thing was teaching people that other aspect, which I learned along the way. Having been trained as clergy, the one thing we were never trained about was compassion. And the educational program we put together for here was based on three things. We did annual events. So the first one was in 2001. It wasn't really ours, but the second one, 2002, was ours. And we did them all the way through 2016. And we had a working theme like the revolving door of homelessness. Or the last one was, it was from the TV, from the radio show, Car Talk. Mm. You know, we built it on that because that's where we were going and with our direct work. But one of the things that became very apparent as we did all those was folks, they kind of liked the common theme that we're all against homelessness. They didn't like the way of being directed or invited to go do things outside their sanctuaries, mm-hmm. their homes, their neighborhoods. And so we had Bill Grace, who was a Center for Ethical Leadership way back when, and he spoke one year about charity and justice. And there was a phrase going around, it still goes around, is we have to get beyond charity to justice. And a lot of my colleagues were saying that, and I kind of didn't like it a whole lot. And when Bill spoke that year, he broke those out, but he also broke out speaking about compassion, which we heightened later in our other events and went to Craig Renabaum and some others to mm-hmm. speak more about. But we knew that we had to make an educational program that encompassed it. So we turned it into, and that's what's in this book, Affirming Charity, Compassion, and Justice. We're all partners. No matter which one you do, there's no wrong door for what you do, as long as you do it, mm-hmm. you know. And then we also realized that if you're doing justice with compassion, you're going to be somebody the politicians will probably listen to, because you have the compassion to know that you're dealing with someone, and compassion's about listening. So you can't practice justice without listening. Same thing for charity. We knew a lot of people who would go to the soup kitchen. I mean, we served in soup kitchens during seminary and in the Mission District in San Francisco. You can't go without listening to the people you're feeding. You have to go out and sit with folks and talk to them and just listen. And so if you're doing charity with compassion, you don't usually burn out. You're kind of eager to go back, actually, you know, and you're not eager to go back to make it bigger and better. You're eager and to go back for those small moments.
The human connection.
The human connection. Yeah. And so during the course of all that, we're learning as we go, it's all about relationships. You know, oh, why didn't you just say so to start with? Well, we're hard to teach, you know. We're not easy to teach, none of us. And relationships scare the bejeevers out of a lot of people, especially when you say, well, who do you want me to be in a relationship with? You know, so that process just kept, you know, weaving itself in and out. And the educational program, I taught it for many years, like in faith communities or with David when David Bloom was going out to, he worked at Antioch for a while teaching mm-hmm. homelessness courses and even had some Muckleshoot classes. And so we would go and I would teach portions of that in a very quick, brief way to do it. But the nice thing that it gave people was that affirm your gift. You've got one. It's either charity, compassion, or justice, or some blend. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a voice, you've got a capacity to act, or you've got a capacity to just sit and be with people. And I would use examples like, have you ever had someone you knew well, cared for, or loved, dying, and you go to the bedside, and you're not telling them mm-hmm. the 3 weeks of things you've just
right.
done. You just sit and listen. And then you come back and you say to the family, you know, somebody made a noise or whatever it might be, but you've been listening mm-hmm. to their breathing and everything. So that's the kind of listening that in the chaplaincy program that Craig did, companionship training and others, we're not ever taught to listen like that to other people. We're always taught to use our monkey brain and to go for it and to fix it, you know, and because I'm housed, I'm capable of fixing everything or anything or something. Or going out and asking people what they need as a delivery system instead of sitting down and just letting them say what they need in a whole nother way of saying it and just listening.
Within a conversation.
Within a conversation, yes. And so that was when I started doing the direct vehicle outreach in 2011. So I was director in 2004. We had never done direct outreach as the organization. David had never done it. And so it was 2011. We noticed that Seattle was passing an ordinance for people living on the street, everybody actually, who weren't paying their tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And four or more tickets would get a boot and then you get impounded. So my colleague Gene Darcy and I were pretty upset about that. So we were able to get some traction with the city of Seattle's executive office, Mayor McGinn. We didn't ever actually meet with him, but Daryl Smith and Jerry DeGreek, they're his staff.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought together all the departments of the city and said, we're going to start a scofflaw mitigation program. And they kind of looked at us like, what the, you know, what are they talking about? And the city attorney's office didn't like it a lot. The police didn't like it a lot. But parking enforcement loved it because parking enforcement now, when they came across someone scofflaw eligible, I mean, you've got three tickets maybe, or maybe you've got four now, and you're going to lose your vehicle. They would contact us and we would go do outreach.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had no public money. We got like $15,000 raised over the course of several years privately. But it wasn't about the money. It was about going out and telling them, well, we have an arrangement with the court. You know, the court is not the evil empire. They will give you community service to work off your ticket, or they'll reduce certain tickets and take them off, or they'll give you a payment plan. So for the first two or three years, I was going with everybody to the court, and the court was just doing exactly what I said I would do. And word got around that, oh, maybe we shouldn't be so afraid of getting our tickets taken care of. And then that takes away the scofflaw threat.
Mm-hmm.
That system, even as bare bones and rudimentary as it was, worked all the way up to the pandemic. We had less than five vehicles that we were attached to get impounded.
During that whole time. Oh, man. Oh, that's a lot.
And we know that there might have been other impounds that we didn't hear about that didn't fall under scofflaw.
Like the ones you're looking at now.
Well, not even quite like the ones I'm looking at now. Maybe it was a junk vehicle, or maybe they were parked on private property. You know, those things that we mm-hmm. couldn't fix. So there were certainly some happening. But the ones that were important during those years were when people were getting tickets.
Right.
And then the government was impounding them. Right now, well, Mayor Durkan stopped scofflaw during the pandemic, which was mm-hmm. meant to be a kindness, I think, you know, in a way, so people didn't have to keep moving during the pandemic. That was a blessing and a curse. The curse part was that when they had to move again, it was really hard. Their mm-hmm. vehicles wouldn't start. They had too much stuff they collected, you know, mm-hmm. all those things. Their health maybe went downhill. And now with this administration, they've resumed some kind of a form of scofflaw, but without the partnership with parking enforcement and the court.
So they just got rid of that connection.
They got
altogether.
Rid of the partnership.
Any rationale that you've been able to discern?
No. Sadly, we've been able to talk to the mayor's office, but not the mayor. So what this produces is, like when I did a public records request earlier this year, for all the impounds between January and May, and they gave that to me. It was 68,000 line items. And I thought, okay, someone come sort this for me. No one was going to come. So I did it. It came out to 31 pages, 1,441 records of RVs,
mm-hmm.
the most likely lived in vehicles, RVs, campers, detached trailers, and buses. Those are pretty much what people will be living in. They live in passenger cars, but I had no way to figure out in that large record which of those were lived in passenger cars.
Right.
So I just kind of counted that as a wash. And then I went in and figured out how many of each one there were. And of course, 72, the RVs topped the list. It was 924 RVs and 483 trailers or something like that. But bigger than that was the infractions that led to the impounds. These were the things the scofflaw team had taken mm-hmm. care of. Number one, 72-hour, 643 got impounded because of a 72-hour mm-hmm. violation that in the past would have been a ticket And we would have been sent out to help them.
So they just went straight to impound.
They went straight to impounds. And it's a deep, dark secret right now. You know, I'm working on it. I did an op-ed with Publicola, and I'm trying to write the homeless project at Seattle Times, mm-hmm. and saying, these numbers show that they're not reflecting sweep and offer shelter. They're not doing that. They're doing it on the remediations, removals, and relocations, which is a formal list the Unified Care team puts out, mm-hmm. and they go out en masse like an army, you know, of police and city workers and giant vehicles, and require people to move from certain scheduled places, and outreach is supposed to go out and help.
Mm-hmm.
Well, city outreach goes out. Our outreach teams at the time would go out simply because they didn't trust that people would be cared for in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the money that, like, when I was leading this program the last couple of years, we're getting money to help people get into housing, but instead we're trailing around the city going to these sites where the remediations are happening and cleaning up the mess so people aren't impounded. And so the good money that's supposed to go into housing is actually going into keeping people alive.
Right.
It's still working that way. So it's a very bit of mess right now. And one of the things I just discovered, and, you know, this is where sometimes something so obvious doesn't hit you no matter how long you do something. And then when it hits you, you think, how could I not have known that?
Yeah.
Well, what hit me this year, and maybe it was the end of last year, but especially this year, and I'm talking about it a lot, is the regional authority and all the plans before it got all the money. And the city said, you know, they're going to give them a lot of money. And it's not enough money, but we're going to give all our money to them and they're going to spend it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing with vehicle residency and even tents, the land on which everybody's camping is public land, and all the laws that govern that land are still in effect. So unless they mitigate or change those laws somehow, we're out there battling an enemy that should be our friend.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the jurisdiction should be our friend. They should be saying things like, oh, okay, we'll relax the 72-hour impounds. You know, we'll find another way for you to do outreach when a person's eligible for that impound.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they're in a prohibited area, we'll give you time to get out there and help them move. Or if they have a detached trailer, which is illegal on the street, we'll give you time and help you get them to move. None of that's happening. And that's mostly Seattle, but all the other 38 cities are doing something similar that no one's watching. Yeah, there's just not as many as there are here. So the problem we face is, so now I draw a circle and half is funding, the other half is the land, the terrain,
mm-hmm.
or the terroir, as we wine aficionados call it. And the problem with that is, unless they cooperate, they're just throwing the money they give away because we're not getting people into even the limited housing we have fast enough to avoid harm. So they lose their vehicle, then they're in a tent, and then they're swept.
And even worse.
Even worse.
Yeah.
And then as women in black, you know, I just posted them in my e-update this week. They're standing again next week.
Mm-hmm.
Or they die. I mean, the deaths are at an all-time high this year. And it's not just accidental. It's not just because of drugs. It's because people are being forced to live outside. And I don't know what I would do if I was forced to live outside. What would be my health cure to keep myself, my trauma from driving me crazy? You know, would I drink? Would I take drugs, which I don't do? I do drink, but not that much. Would I drink more? What would I do to calm mm-hmm. myself down? You know, when I started this, no one was talking, in 2001, no one was talking about trauma. There were books written about mm-hmm. it, you know, I've discovered because I've ordered some of them. And even some of the folks you've had on here have been people who I've learned about trauma from, Ken mm-hmm. Crable, for example.
Right.
And I just kind of went, like, when did this start? You mean it's not PTSD? You know, it's not a stress? It's not a little blue dot on my, mm-hmm. you know, it's not any of that. It's worse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's worse and it's better, but it's worse. At least there's a better aspect to it because you can then begin to learn. It's like Rebecca Demrell wrote her book, Nothing's for Nothing,
yeah,
Transformation
that's a great book.
Through Trauma.
Yeah.
In other words, you don't get rid of it. You learn when you see the red door, oh, you know, that used to drive me crazy. It's a red door.
All right. Like studies on war veterans who were in combat. but who also were homeless. They say that homelessness was the worst trauma of their life over being in an actual war.
Yeah, there's just no
crazy.
Peace.
Yeah.
And so I'm leading all this stuff and at the same time having to learn this as if, like, I hope nobody notices I didn't know what I was talking about on that. But that's part of the learning is listening to others, you know, even as people are doing other things now, you know, being an outreach worker with a staff that had different pronouns or that had a dead name. In other words, don't call me that. That's my dead name. And I'm kind of going, okay, I you know, what do? You keep learning and just honor that. So the landscape, and that's why I know people in faith communities, when I reach back to them, they're scared by all that. It's just, it's too much. It's confrontation is not the right word, but it's like too much of a feeling I don't know what I'm doing.
The unsettling, yeah.
But that is the feeling that you need to have to be compassionate, which is, you know, Craig Rennebaum and I still have coffee every few weeks and we still talk about this stuff and we're still trying to figure out how to inform the regional authority on doing this because it's so key to be a healer in any shape or form for those on the streets. You know, often they need folks who are living in unhoused, not everybody, but many of them need respite. You know, they need can I go get out of this and go on vacation for 2 weeks and then come back and live on the streets again? There is none of that, you know, nothing even close. And with the sweeps going now and then the ecology blocks or NIMBY blocks that they're putting up and there's folks counting them now, they put those in the right of way and then you can't park there. So the amount of space on the streets is declining.
For everybody, housed or unhoused.
Yeah. And then this all comes back again to that other half of the circle, controlling the streets. And what are you controlling it with? I ended up using in the closing of my op-ed recently something I read, because I'm reading for this other thing I'm writing, a lot of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Bonhoeffer and King is the book. And Bonhoeffer spent a lot of time trying to make sense out of the Nazis and what his faith response would be. And he swiveled back and forth. But the one thing he came up early on with a description for what he thought of them was he thought they had a contempt for humanity. And I let that sit in me for a while. And I think when I say that elected officials are often the cause of our not making progress because they control the purse strings and the streets, I think that they're all struggling with that, having a contempt for certain portions of humanity. Like if they would just get their act together, if they would just pull themselves up, you know, that old one, by their bootstraps, if they would move to another city.
Or get off drugs.
All those things. The list is forever. But the point ends up being it's not being able to have any kind of sensibility that this is a human being. If it was a daughter or a son, a grandchild, we would look at it way differently, and we do. Somehow that element of that old puritanical judgmental thing is embedded in our country's way of looking at the vulnerable. And now we've got refugees. We've got asylum seekers. I mean, down in Riverton Park, there were 180 combination asylum seekers, refugees. They're coming in at the airport. They're coming across the border. They're all looking for a safe place. They have no documentation, nothing. Mm-hmm. And so now they're calling the homeless, American homeless, refugees, asylum seekers.
And we like to sort people.
Yeah. And that wouldn't be so bad, except for we have hardly anything coherent for any of these. And we lack housing for all of them. And the meeting I was at was being led by all white people, almost all white people. And the people who were of color there, of African and other nationalities, were saying, you need to let us lead these meetings. And I thought, amen. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm a white pastor and I wore a clergy shirt that day and I didn't come to tell you what to do. I came to listen. And I'm fine with immigrants leading these remedies, but in conjunction, because it's like I've said about the homeless people, when the Lived Experience Coalition wants to be running the regional authority, all I know is that the homeless people that I've spent time with don't see much beyond their block of survival.
Mm-hmm.
Like Soto doesn't see Ballard. You hear about it now and then, word of mouth. It's usually wrong. But to go from being homeless to into a leadership position, that's a tough jump. It's not that we don't need to have the folks there. We do. But it's a gradual thing. It's the same thing I've done to get where I am even in this work, constantly learning, you know, and constantly listening.
Mm-hmm.
Because what the view of what's happening out on the streets is street talk. Some of it's true, some of it's not. And it's hard then when I don't know what the system's doing to go out. And it was very hard when they would ask, well, what's going to happen? I didn't have good news to bring. You know, that's very disheartening to workers. That's why we see a drop in the nonprofit sector workers,
mm-hmm.
and outreach workers, and shortages, and so many jobs empty. Secondary trauma. We're killing ourselves.
Well, yeah, especially after the pandemic.
And no remedy to bring them. No, I said to Peter Lynn, the second in command, I said, I don't have good news to bring people. I have to have some good news to mm-hmm. bring to them. I said, if I don't have good news, then this authority should disband until it can figure out what the good news is. You know, that we're gonna be doing something. We're trying to start what we called nests, and now it's called safe zones, taking 5 RVs on a public right-of-way, making that a space,
mm-hmm.
a protected space, no law enforcement. Code of conduct. Everyone agrees that they're going to start a pathway to get into housing. Give them case management, porta potties, trash, whatever else they need, bus tickets, anything else they need, food. But because we don't have enough RV safe lots, the only one we have is still not even open. It's mm-hmm. like going to be 26 RVs, and we've got 400 to 600. I don't know. We don't know how many we have. It's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We know that half the last point in time count, half the unshelters were in RVs. And so we don't really know what we have right now. So the hard thing, though, is that coming up with anything strategic requires looking at where folks are and what resources we have. And no one wants to look at where they are as a resource. I mean, if they're living safe on the street in a non-prohibited area where RVs can be, and they're not in front of any retail business because that would be a prohibited area, and we can begin to do outreach to them, it's kind of like, I mean, folks at Reach and others were kind of going, it seems like a no-brainer to us,
mm-hmm.
but they're so resistant to it. And so we've been talking to the executive's office, and we talked to council. And when I talked to council about it, they said, well, what's the problem? We put cafes on the right-of-way. There's hundreds of expanded restaurants mm-hmm. on the right-of-way now.
That's true.
You go down the Ave, and it's like, I mean, I just ate at Big Time Brewery a few mm-hmm. weeks ago.
Yeah, they've taken over.
I mean, yeah. And so between ecology blocks and car rentals and cafes, the right-of-way is getting used left, right, and otherwise. But we can't put 5 RVs there
and
to help them get out of
homelessness. Provide services, yeah.
So something's going on that befuddles me, and that sometimes I want to go and scream on the 7th floor at City Hall. Of course, screaming, just that's another one you're on their bad list,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. So you can't scream. Always have to be nice. So that's often why I wear a collar, because people don't like screaming at clergy persons. They bring
that's
up
good.
All that guilt and shame
right,
from their
right.
youth. Yeah.
yeah.
Well, the hard thing we have right now is it's like the leadership doesn't really want to do what it needs to do, even if it's not that hard to move us forward. It's like, oh, no, we can't do that. It's like one of those labyrinths that, like St. Mark's Cathedral mm-hmm. has one out front, only it doesn't go all the way around.
That's right. There's no exit.
Yeah. You start walking and then it stops. Okay, I'll go back this way. And you start walking and it stops over here. And Craig Renabaum used to describe the mental health situation that way.
Yeah.
So he would walk with clients, and he, a mental health professional, could not walk them through the system because the gaps were too big. And so how would any client mm-hmm. ever do that? The system is still plagued by that kind of lack of, it's not even imagination. Lack of coherence of any journey. It'd be like, I'm going to drive to California. I'm going to skip Oregon. I'm not going to go to Idaho. I'm not going to go on. How are you going to do it? I mean, I just, it's hard to not, I mean, I wish that I was alone with some of them and say, so that I could hear them explain that to me, why these things can't happen.
You think they'd really tell you? Or that they even know?
Well, for an elected, not if it's ever going to get back to voters.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the flaw in the system. That's why when Mark Dones proposed a system with a governing committee that had no electeds on it. And then the King County Council went and changed it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they said, because we're responsible for the money. The governing committee has very little to do with the operations in any way, shape, or form. They don't need to sit on that board to control the money.
Mm-hmm.
But it could have been an actually active, helpful board instead of what it is, which is 4 times a year they get together and rubber stamp things.
Mm-hmm.
Or they say, no, we're not going to give you that much. I haven't heard them say we're going to give you more yet. So the hard thing is that, you know, when they started the Interfaith Task Force on Homelessness in 2001 at St. Mark's Cathedral, mm-hmm. they gave us a byline, and we still use it, creating the political will to end homelessness. And people have said that's going to be the hardest part mm-hmm. of the work. And it is the hardest part. And it's a little cognitively dissonant, because we think most people want to help others. We watch people in faith communities reach into their pockets to help people one-on-one. We watch even strangers. You're hearing about it all the time mm-hmm. on local news. Someone stopped. I mean, John Fox told a story yesterday about in his own neighborhood, some young man was lying on the ground. And John was out for a run, and he stopped to see what was wrong. And another neighbor came over, stopped. And after a while, the young man started coming awake, and then he seemed like he was going to be okay. John had called 911 and they had to cancel that. And the young man then finally said, I can't believe you two
that
both
stopped.
That you stopped to help me. I just thought, that's the parable of our times. Mm-hmm. I can't believe you stopped. And if you're going to be on the Today Show for stopping, you know, that's like what it is. And so there's this ordinary duty as human beings, one to another, where we don't have that contempt for humanity. You know, like, okay, we want to be careful. I don't want to be robbed. You know, I'm going to use due diligence. I'm going to protect myself when I need to, but I'm not going to leave you in harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll bring more help with me or something. And that's what's going on with homelessness. I've had so many people who want me to be part of a movement with them when really all they're doing is creating transit-oriented development housing, and they need a homeless voice to deal with the neighbors and the other people. And I just think that's not part of something coherent. Sure, I want housing, but I don't want us to act like, well, the homeless are the ones we have to take care of to get this project done. So I just don't really understand what's happening in people's heads, and I really would like to have them alone. In fact, at times I wish I was a Catholic priest and I could have them in the confessional. Yeah. That's yeah, maybe funny. Your faith will get you to tell the truth here. That's not true for Protestants. They feel free to lie. Other faiths, maybe, I don't know. But the point ends up being is, what is it that goes on for folks who have that responsibility and a duty?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we learned that when we did some of our first events, you know, that we have Muslims in our group, especially at the start, and Jewish folks. And when they would say, why do you do this? And they said, it's the duty of our faith. Duty.
Mm-hmm.
When a Christian would speak about it, I said, the Christians weren't able to really come up with any. So I said, well, Jesus says, do this. Close to a duty. But we're able to go, I'm not ready for that today.
Mm-hmm.
But where do we get that sense of duty? I mean, we talk about it as citizens, that there's a duty we have to each other. So, you know, and I just always come back to love neighbor as self. And that's in part because I'm clergy. But at the same time, I think a lot of people actually believe that about the way they want to live.
Mm-hmm.
They'd like to know their neighbors. They want to feel safe. And that was Cher's message. The first thing I learned working with homeless, it's about safety. Safety for the homeless person, safety for the people who aren't homeless, safe. And I've thought about it so often that even when I do pray, and I don't pray all the time, but when I pray, I give thanks for being safe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an enormous thing. I don't think we understand how that affects our whole body, our physiology and everything. And when we're not safe, you know, that sense of trauma or fear, what that does to us.
Yeah, what it does to our whole selves.
Yeah, we think well, I graduated high school. I understand all that. Well, I got a master's degree. I don't understand it. So I don't know what it's going to take for that except some enlightened leadership that just stands firm and says we're going to do this. You know, we need to do this. I mean, I see some of that in some of the things President Biden has done. I've seen that in a few things the governor's done or legislators, Frank Chop, others. You know, you may not all be on board with this, but we're going to stand firm and do this because we need to do this. This is who we are. And yet there's too little of that in any sense where, like with this regional plan now, the first thing I heard after they were going to take away the partnership for zero was, oh, they're going to end the plan now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they need to end that plan. Yeah, that's not doing anything. And I'm going, no, I don't think it's quite that way. But to battle, there's no way to battle. Yeah, it's like Gene Darcy used to say, Billy, you're using common sense. There's no way to battle it with common sense because it's not about common sense for folks. They just think someone's getting something they're not getting, something for nothing.
They don't deserve it.
They don't deserve it, all those things. And that's hard to battle. And even for people of faith, they slide into that. You know, it's my wife is still in the parish doing visitation and a few other things. But she constantly comes back to me and says, do you know what so-and-so said? And I just think, yeah, I can kind of guess. Because we're people. You know, we're all broken. We say to each other, St. Paul said, all sin and fall short of the glory of God. You know, as a reminder. Us too. But people don't like being told they're human, that they're going to make mistakes. I do think, though, people like it when we do better. I think they like it when their home team wins. I think they like it when spring arrives in Seattle, for example. There's just a lot of things people love, and there's not a lot of room to live that way, you know, until you're in like the labyrinth, constantly running into something that blocks the pathway. I think, though, some of what I saw on the journey from various people at the very start was very encouraging. The corporate people who came in to help write the 10-year plan, people like Dan Brettler, he was remarkable. And Blake Nordstrom, he was remarkable. And others, John Fine, who was at United Way, people from Weyerhaeuser and others, they came in with a very serious sense of duty. And in that regard, and Bill Block, who was running that program, who just died recently, waiting for his service, that was one of the good things out of the first plan, was that people had a moral compass attaching to it all. And the second plan was more, let's try to fix what was wrong
with the
first plan.
One, right?
And it wasn't as much a sense of the moral compass that as a region, this is how we should be. It's like, and we've also lost that in the religious area. We don't have a religious organization that brings together all of the religious leaders to stand up and say, we have a call to be moral, to be people of goodwill to others. And my colleague, who's now the deacon for the Episcopals in the Diocese of Olympia, we're talking about, well, let's get some of those important religious leaders back together. Father Ryan is still around. He did it before. Pastor Thorson at St. Mark's and others, Danny Wiener, get them to just start saying this out loud so that there's a sense from those who think about moral things that there are moral things to think about, and it's not just an elected leader telling you that when they give some speech, which, you know, I think, did that start with, well, it's probably before Bill Clinton, but too many times the president or someone tried to be the pastor. It doesn't work. Yeah. Even now, the mayor can't be the pastor. And I would think that they would want a cadre of people of faith, although I think right now the hard thing would be who they would convict. Yeah, and I'm not having it yet with the current mayor. More sweeps than any mayor since I've been living in Washington. And it's not like we have the shelter to offer. We don't. I mean, especially for those 1,441, we don't have enough.
Yeah, and that's what he's delivering on his promises. I mean, it was very clear during the election. I mean, coming up to the election, that's what he was planning to do.
He just didn't count on the Ninth Circuit passing Martin versus Boise.
Right.
Although that was before he was elected.
Yeah.
Or Johnson versus Grant's pass. But in the position he's in, he can't ignore it, and he does. And I think even the Seattle Times is looking at that. Is Martin versus Boise being followed?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer was, well, quickly, no, it's not.
Yeah, all sorts of loopholes that they've made. Yeah.
And there are other remedies if we can't give them shelter, which is to give people a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
All the way back to when Scott was saying that and I was listening.
Mm-hmm.
How can we find a safe place?
Or a wheel for women.
Same thing, yeah. Exactly. Share a wheel. They're still trying to pull their weight on that message. Yeah. Anitra Freeman testifies at all the regional meetings about how many people have died.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, bless her. But at the same time, that board listens, but that board, mm-hmm. none of those people are elected.
Right.
So, I mean, where does that message root? Where does it bloom? Where do we then all say, oh, look at what we've done together? I mean, it's like, what was the – was it the Seahawks where they had the parade years ago down 3rd or 4th or one of the streets and 700,000 or 800,000 people came out?
We get behind football, yeah.
I mean, I would think if we ended – well, we're not going to quite end it. But if we did like 90% of homelessness into housing – and people are still going to be falling into homelessness. But, I mean, that would be worthy of a parade.
Mm-hmm.
And would everybody feel like they had a role in it, even if it was, well, I support this and I vote for it? That's the minimal role. The bigger role would be we might help feed, which is another huge problem still, food.
Mm-hmm.
Food and a roof overhead are both the big problems. And I mean, I shower every day. I sometimes feel guilty about that. And at the same time, I think, well, no, guilt isn't going to do it for me. I'm just aware that I have that as a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then I've succumbed with a few elected officials to using – I was raised Catholic, so guilt and shame were just right there, you
mm-hmm.
know. And we all suffer them, you know, but they're very different things. Shame is about making someone less of a person. Guilt is just something I really need to fix for myself. But we have a lot of shaming going on right now, which is what alarms me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're shaming people for who they are, or shaming them for their circumstance. And I just don't understand that among people who others say they're such good people. I mean, I hear that a lot about, for example, the mayor,
mm-hmm.
such a good person. And I knew him from council. So I don't know what to do with that. I need more advice. I need to listen to somebody. But I would love to meet and be able to hear what's going on. You know, a confessional would be helpful. Just say it. You know, don't hold on to it. Or who are you listening to? Who are you not listening
mm-hmm.
to? And that's always the big one. When I wasn't doing direct service prior to 2011, I thought after I started direct service, how did I do my job for 10 years without listening to the people on the street?
Yeah, that connection with direct service is definitely an important component.
I mean, I would meet homeless people at conferences and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Not the same as being where they are.
On the street.
On the street.
Yeah. So what gives you hope?
Well, I see a lot of, given my age and whether I stop soon, probably next year sometime, I see a lot of people who still have a fire in their belly
mm-hmm.
about other people and what they're seeing and what they can do and knowing they don't have to wait for someone to give them permission to do it and that they can be very creative with other avenues that are available in our society. I mean, someone at a meeting yesterday said, well, we're applying for a grant with this and AI. And I thought, oh, and AI. They're using AI to help apply for the grant. And I just thought, okay, don't judge them. You don't know what they're talking about. But I think that is the kind of creativity that's going to be necessary. I don't know yet whether that'll overcome this, I keep thinking of Johnny Cash, Ring of Fire, this thing that exists among elected officials, like they just don't listen well enough. And even when they do listen to some of us, they never call us back. I mean, it's been my number one complaint in the past 2 years, especially for the number of people we've had meetings with, and then I can't get back in touch with them. I mean, I keep thinking about going to their office and waiting.
Mm-hmm.
But their time frame is like, I know you have a lot of things, but when you're, say, let's just pick on poor Andrew Lewis for right now, he's running for office again. Mm-hmm. He's done some great conversations with us. But when it came to having a panel in front of that committee that's homelessness and public assets, or public assets and homelessness, and I'm looking at the agenda week to week, and there's nothing on the agenda about homelessness, and we're talking about the safe zones,
mm-hmm.
privately, Zooms, and we're talking about this other stuff, how can we not get a panel to talk about it there and make it
kind of real.
Make it kind of real, yeah. And like the money for the RV safe lot, that sat in the Seattle City Council for 2 years before the RHA was ever formed. Teresa Mosqueda set that aside, $1.9 million, or 1.2, whatever it was then.
Mm-hmm.
It sat in the Seattle Council's hands doing nothing for 2 years. Regional authority comes in, they hand it over to them, and then belatedly now we're finally 2 years into the regional authority, we're almost ready to get an RV safe lot that we should have had almost 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And then they're disbanding the vehicle residency committee.
They're disbanding the subgroup for Seattle, as far as I can understand.
Okay.
I got a phone call this week that said I'm disinvited from the subcommittee, because they want it to be all providers. And then I wrote back and I said, well, how many is that? That's less than one hand's worth of people. I don't know, think they know what they're doing yet.
Mm-hmm.
I've said to them a lot that they have hired nobody in their entire employee list who knows how to do vehicle residency. Nobody. The big agencies never had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're great. You know, they're great for everything else. DESC, Plymouth, they're all great for everything else. Youth care. But they haven't had to do vehicle residency. Even REACH didn't have to do it. They had behavioral health mm-hmm. and you know, limited targets. But when half the unsheltered are in vehicles.
And growing, probably.
And because that's where they can go when they lose their house. I just keep saying to them, we need a plan. And I don't know if it's just the embarrassment of not having something right up in front or what it is. But we finally kind of did a ultimatum. One of the Seattle staff said, we don't think anybody takes you seriously as an official group of RHA. And so we took that to RHA. Are we an official group or not?
Mm-hmm.
We were the first group formed out of the chute when Mark Dones and Alexis and Naomi were the only three employees.
Mm-hmm.
They formed this group.
I remember that, yeah.
And so we've been meeting for more than 2 years. But we don't get funding. We don't get a say in any RFPs. We don't get a say in any policy. We have meetings, and we don't know where the input goes.
Mm-hmm.
Because we see it doesn't show up in the funding. So we just had I'll call it a come to Jesus moment, and had Peter Lynn, the chief program officer, come to our meeting. And he's kind of saying, well, of course you're real. It's like the Velveteen Rabbit. Of course you're real.
That's right. Go play with those wild rabbits.
Yeah, that was 2 weeks ago. Yeah. Mm. And then we hear from the mayor's office that they just want a proposal on the safe zones. Oh, okay. So staff from REACH and I were supposed to give that. Then the next day I get a call, well, we're disinviting you from the vehicle residence subcommittee. What? And then that same other person says, oh, no, I think they're just discontinuing that committee entirely. And I said, why?
we're on the cusp of working with Seattle.
And actually having something.
To do this tangibly. And I said, I can't help but think this order came from Seattle. Why would RHA end it? So that's when I began to think, there's things that I wish people would tell me and that I think they're keeping from me because they don't want to upset their voting constituencies who got them into office. That's really what's happening here, I think. And I can't prove it, and it's hard to even say it out loud, except to say you're continuing the harm, you know, the things we need to say. You're not following the Ninth Circuit. You're not doing these other things that you need to be doing. And truth be told, we hear from the lawyers, if we find the right candidate, they'll sue them for us. We're trying to avoid that. We could sue right now. We could find one candidate, like Jack Potter is Supreme Court hearing Tuesday. We could find that one candidate in Seattle and get the lawyers who would say, we take that case right now and sue Seattle. And the Superior Court's already looking at their over-ambitious definition of sweeps. So that'll happen soon. And that comes back to, well, we'll do it if we're forced to, not because it's the right thing to do.
Right. But then there's still will be ways around that, most likely.
Exactly.
Because it's already happened. Yeah.
And so, I mean, what gives me hope is I think I'm just one of those personalities that doesn't like having you tell me no when you're wrong and when what I'm knowing is right is right. And when my wife and I first came into the Lutheran Church, which is the one we were ordained in, they had the first black bishop in Southern California. And we had been ignored because we got assigned to the Midwest and they didn't like couples. So we went and talked to him. And he said, of course, I'll take you, you know, and helped us get a call. But what he said was when anyone told him he couldn't do anything, he said, well, that's like saying sick him to a bulldog, you know, the old phrase. And I've just kept him in my head, you know, that there are things that we just have to do that in spite. I mean, the reason I went to seminary was someone pretty well known, Daniel Berrigan. He came to the Graduate Union in Berkeley when my wife had started seminary. I wasn't in. And I listened to him and I thought, why would I get an MSW and listen to people one by one and their worldview and their issues when really what I'm called to is outside of a room, outside of 50 minutes. And so I switched. I went to seminary. It's because how we treat each other is there is a one-to-one aspect, and a lot of people can benefit from therapy for themselves and for how they – mostly for how they deal with others as well. But that wasn't where I was really called to be. I was really, you know, all these things I'm discovering as I do this is where I belonged. Even now that I'm off the street, I have to figure out, well, my health this year has not been good, so I'm glad I wasn't on the street. I wouldn't have survived it, especially this spring. I lost so much energy from a few procedures, I could hardly walk around the block. And that energy's back, mostly, but not entirely. So I give thanks that I had it last year when I was doing the work, when I was out in the rain and working with the teams to get them staffed and supplied and everything. But there's an aspect about this. I've also said that I didn't have time during all those years to go do the work with the legislators and the others. I said, they're harder than the people on the streets.
Yeah.
It was easier to deal with the outreach than this. And so I have to kind of keep reframing things and leave myself room to get angry and get angry when where I need to and when I need to, like with my friends yesterday having coffee, get angry with them, and then just let it begin to, you know, not to keep it bottled up. Use writing for some of it. But I don't like that. I mean, we have a great garden. I put some of the time into that. Family, grandkids. None of it is perfect in terms of alleviating this. You know, I've asked other colleagues who just like Rick Reynolds just recently retired and others. And I said, well, how do you stop thinking about all this? Oh, you don't?
Right.
I mean, I still have the same phone number. People still call me up to 15 times a week for help. And a lot of the time now, I don't answer it. I listen to the messages because I couldn't possibly help all them. And one out of all the 15, I might be able to help anyway. But I think it's just the I think it's the burden every citizen should feel. You know, I think in the medical profession, people feel that for patients. You know, total strangers coming in, caring for them, often beyond the boundaries of the duty, you know. And with, there are plenty of professions. I would hope police would be that way. They're kind of sketchy on it right now. You know, there's some police, you know. I mean, the first police officer that I really had to deal with was way back in the early 2000s. I had just become director. Camp Quixote was in Olympia. It was a tent city. And I went to the Unitarian Church for a hearing on an encampment. And Lieutenant Costa was there from the Olympia Police Department. He said, I don't know what I'm going to say. I said, I think he'll find the right words. And he looked like my son, who were, they both looked like G.I. Joe. You know, just, yeah. And so he said, he stood up when it was his turn. It's not illegal to be homeless. If you see someone who's homeless, don't call me. If you see someone who's breaking the law, call me. And he sat down.
They just called it.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Oh. I've looked up to see whether he's still working. I just thought, best speech ever.
It's true. Don't call me.
Well, you know, and we see that all the time. Still, there's a strange RV parked in my neighborhood. Well, if it's in their neighborhood, it shouldn't be there, number one. I often say that to folks. If it's in your neighborhood, it shouldn't be there. That's a prohibited area. They're not zoned for that. But they don't mean their neighborhood. What they mean is over by the tracks, about four blocks from where I live, but along that stretch where they're allowed to park. Yeah, that's what they really mean.
Right.
Yeah. Like along, was it Thorndike or was it? Along that street, yeah.
Or over near the parks, yeah.
Well, and they're not supposed to be near parks either. But and so a lot of times we're just giving people information and saying, well, you're correct. We'll see if we can take care of that. That's part of what we did under the Scofflaw outreach. We did those things too. We would be referred out to correct situations even by the police. We had good relationships with the police even before Chief Diaz was chief. I would see him, not the chief. He was a deputy chief. And I would see him. I would see a couple others. And they would be very helpful. There were two impounds. They got reversed that should not have been impounded. And so, I mean, we always had a good relationship with them because we're part of public safety, too. That's why we're out there.
And the solution.
Yeah. And you know, sure, we haven't got all the tools we need yet. Not even close. But that's what troubles me when I see the current mayor taking away tools we had. And that ordinance was passed when he was on council. And he was the only one to amend it, which was to put notice on the vehicle instead of mailing it, which was always a problem. So he knows about that ordinance really well and that he would not allow it to continue. It troubles me. I don't understand why. I think someone's feeding him information that is not serving him or the city. Because resuscitating that program, and they'd need more people now because we have way more RVs, but to avoid then the 72-hour impounds, this list, to avoid this. This is 5 months.
That is pretty stark. So that's probably going to come out.
I'm going to make sure it comes out one way or another. If Public Cola passes, publishes, thank you, it'll start to come out there. If the Times wants to, it'll come out there.
Yeah.
But it's not like I've kept it secret. I know some of the business improvement areas have already heard the numbers. And one person apparently said, oh, there's no way that could be true because there's only like 500 or 600 impound spaces in a lot. And I went, this is over 5 months. This is 8 per day. Spaces, notwithstanding, and they're auctioning. They're not actually allowed to auction under Long versus Seattle, but they are junking. And after 30 days, then they can do those things.
Then they can do that, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, they have plenty of ways to clear a space. Plus, they have places down in Burien.
Right.
I've gone down there.
Overflow.
Yeah. First Avenue is now bulging at the seams. So it's just – and here's what my colleague Jean used to say. If they would stop this, they would save money. And it's true.
Mm-hmm.
The impounds are expensive. It's expensive interpersonally to people. It's expensive just in the process.
The administration and everything else.
Everything else.
Yeah.
It's like taking the worst pathway as a remedy.
Right. And Sarah Rankin and her crew, Seattle U, have really documented that well.
Yeah, I was a judge on several of those with the students. We worked with them on both the one on faith community and on vehicles. And I had a lot of people don't even know those exist anymore, those studies.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, things aren't better.
No.
Yeah, and so the hard thing is, and UW was involved with the safe zones last year. We got a call. There's a stub of a street down here below the Northlake building.
Right, I know it.
And we were all ready to go. We had the proposal laid out. And apparently it came through Seattle that the city attorney told us it wouldn't be legal to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sally Clark told me about that.
And we said, some of us said, well, why don't we just do it? What are they going to do? There's vehicles there anyway right now. I kind of wish we had gone ahead and done it. We didn't. Eventually, UW got a little chilled to it over whatever reasons, and it didn't happen at all. So I'm not sure where the next thrust of all this will go, especially with the regional authority. I know they're asking groups like REACH out of Evergreen Treatment to take on more vehicle residency. Our group was the only one funded to do vehicle residency. We had four people in the field, and the budget was $206,000 out of, you know, how big the budget is for everything. And I thought, and this is for half of the unsheltered. The cognitive dissonance of all this is like any eighth grader would tell you, this is not square here. And on top of that for the regional authority, now they've hired Graham Pruss, and you know Graham, to be a consultant to the vehicle residency work groups. But Graham's on a tether, you know. They only want him to go a few places. They don't want him to just be grand and take it all on. I don't think they want the vehicle residency work groups to be grand either. So right now I'm in the throes of when you say what gives me hope. What gives me hope is the chance to just have a serious talk with my friends. And I count these people who are working on this my friends. You know, that we're in this together. What are you doing? You know, who is putting the pressure on you? Let's just say it. How bad can it be? I mean, if it's the mayor, if it's Dow Constant, whoever it is, it's not as bad as this, you know? And we've been through this with the county. The county thinks... The county did a report in May of last year saying the vehicle residency work group of the regional authority and quoting and all the things we're doing. And we kind of went, well, they think we're real. You know, they don't think we're a velveteen rabbit. I know I heard on the Hidden Brain on cognitive dissonance a few weeks ago. And I thought, oh, this is perfect. I should frame that episode because it seems like the whole process we're working on right now is that, besides trauma and harm and death and where can people have their voice heard respectfully, but also not there's that sense with those who are homeless, especially people of color, that when they speak, we should jump because they're speaking. No, I think we treat them like people. We have a conversation, you know, and we give them the chance, the various sectors a chance to lead and take things on. And instead of just being, it's so knee-jerk right now. Everyone's so afraid of offending somebody. I think that's, I've got that down really well. I think I've got that one down. But yes, it's not producing what we want to see. So that's when it goes back to the affirming charity, compassion, and justice. Mm-hmm. And the justice aspect of practicing compassion with those we're trying to get to change, of listening.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the first meeting I had with the executive office, and I won't say who it was, but it was one of the deputy mayors, was on Zoom, May of last year. I was alone. There were like 8 people on the other end of the call. They were all people of color. And the first half hour of the meeting was about why would we, and looked around, want to listen to you as a white person?
Mm-hmm.
First half hour of the meeting. And so I've told my friends, I said, you know, the Holy Spirit said, just don't say anything. Let it go for a while. And I did. And I said, well, what I've said already, well, a good share of me is here to listen, you know, but we do have something to offer as well.
Mm-hmm.
In the second half hour, the Nest proposal was liked. That was in May of 2022. Now the committee to oversee the Nest, what, doesn't exist anymore?
Mm-hmm.
Even you know that.
Right.
I'm just going, whoa. Yeah.
There's that.
There's that.
There's that.
Well, but there's also that sense of still, of in the exercise of power, thinking it's supreme by those who are exercising it, and not understanding that the court might be around the corner, or there might be a refusal to obey around the corner, or various things like that collectively can happen. I mean, we're watching that with strikes right now.
Mm-hmm.
Homeless people want to strike. People in vehicles want to strike. They want to just plant themselves somewhere where you cannot move them. Well, they move them from the side. But people are that tired of this. So it's not just me. I caution them, well, don't get impounded. You'll lose your vehicle. But something has to happen. People in our vehicle residency work group who are living in vehicles are way angrier than I am. And I'm pretty angry. I just don't understand why we aren't doing the cost-effective, caring way of dressing people that's not contempt.
Because
right now I think contempt is ruling the day. And almost every jurisdiction has its form. And, you know, that's beyond our region too, but it's when you get into the big political party sectors, well, it's even obviously worse. But just, you know, you probably experience this. I'm in line somewhere, like at a market, and something good happens, and we don't ask ourselves, are you a conservative or a liberal? Are you, you know, we don't ask mm-hmm. ourselves any of those things. We just get along with each other. I'm trying to find the elixir that makes that happen.
Well, being in person, for one thing.
Being in person is a big one.
Yeah.
So how do we get folks in person to where they begin to realize, well, I thought, and I was wrong.
Mm-hmm. There's still work to be done, Bill.
Yeah, your next interviewee will do it.
Yeah. So thank you so much for taking time today to talk about
it. No, it's nice talking about it. All the time I get to talk about it just helps me formulate where the gaps
mm-hmm.
and where the things that need to have focus are and where things are futile and where they may be efficacious.
And our roles in it as individuals and
yeah, I mean I'm winding groups. Down, but at the same time, what I realize is I can't afford to simply quit because this is how I said it to Peter Lynn and a few others. I said I'm ready to quit when you guys have your act together.
So maybe you're winding up.
Well, I think what I want them to know is that I can still be pretty confrontive and irritating
mm-hmm.
And it's not even being nasty to them. It's just pursuing that why.
Right. It's important.
Who's deciding this? That's the first thing I wrote back about disinviting me. Who decided this?
Mm-hmm.
Where did this come from? I might agree with it, but not until I know.
Mm-hmm. It's asking questions.
Transparency.
Yeah.
Yeah, and inclusion. These are big words that I still write about them. And exclusion, usually bad. Inclusion, helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Transparency, helpful. These are practices that, personal disciplines, even marriages,
Yes.
I don't think I'll be so transparent with my spouse about where I was the last 3 weeks. That works well, doesn't
it?
It
always works well.
How did it work last time? Not so well.
Not so good.
Anyway.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for
the copy
of your book.
And thank you for the invite. And I will send you John and David's.
And David's.
If you're
that would be great.
Wanting to be in dialogue with them. They each have their, as you know, their own unique story to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm also really interested, Jen Adams.
She had her picture there. You did her, didn't you?
Yeah. And it was an amazing interview. People like yourself who've been working in this for a long time, and also people like Jen who have that lived experience, but then that bigger, more compassionate, not narrow-minded view. So if you know people like
Jen's
that.
Yeah, Jen's grown a lot. I think she came into this, almost 10 years. And she kind of came in on Jean's coattails. And apparently we had helped her. I hardly remember. But she didn't really formally, we didn't really have a staff until we got to Urban League. We didn't really have a team doing the outreach. I mean, Jen was helping Jean. And then Jean gradually couldn't go out as much.
Mm-hmm.
So we became far more formal once the public money came in, and we. But even then, RHA just gave us a lump of money. I mean, on one hand, that's a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no criteria that we have to match. They wanted to know how we were spending it all, and then this came from Seattle also. They wanted us to tell everyone, they wanted us to refer everyone to shelter who was in a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that is nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to make up those numbers. I said, if you forget, I don't care. I'm just going to send in numbers because it's nonsensical. I said, it's almost like a slap in the face. And they didn't understand that. So they have a separate place on the report. How many people did you refer to shelter?
That's what they want to report out to people. Yeah.
Well, everybody.
Everybody.
Are you happy?
Have you ever heard the word shelter?
Yeah. Can you show me where that shelter is?
Right.
Yeah. But so then there's no institutional learning. We sent the year-end figures in and showed them how we spent it. And that's for the institution to learn, they needed this much for this or this much for this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, without having that guidance, they can't form policy or budget or do anything. They can't keep sending lumps of money out. I mean, I ended up using a lot of it to raise their pay like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jen was getting $35 an hour when I stopped. I thought, well, she has no benefits.
Mm-hmm.
She needs to be paid more than other outreach workers.
Definitely.
Who are hourly. But that's still not enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of, sometimes there's too much room. But yeah, Jen's and her colleagues now, we were able to get Maya, who's actually, I met her when she was doing babysitting at my church.
Oh, wow.
But now she has a full ride PhD
mm-hmm.
offer.
Yeah, she does, right.
And I'm just encouraging her. I said, I told Alexis, just encourage her not to let that go.
Mm-hmm.
Being on the streets is important, but you need the, if you can have the bandwidth of a title, degrees,
mm-hmm.
go get them.
Right. I'm looking forward to my students going out with them.
And then Jonah is on the South team.
Yeah, he's great. I met him yesterday.
He's an Energizer Bunny about
all
this.
Yeah, he's good.
His dad wrote me the other day.
Oh, really?
Yes,
to
apparently.
Thank you?
No, it was a question about something. I forget. Oh, thank you. Yeah. It was a question about something to do with what was just going on with the Partnership for Zero or something. And then Jonah was going, well, did you say anything about this, you know? And because Jonah's in that role that he's in, he hasn't heard all the things I was able to say that I was mm-hmm. able to do, because my whole hat didn't prevent me from doing advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really getting the public money. I didn't take salary from the program. I still took it from the ITFH.
Mm-hmm.
So I was never silenced the way public money recipients
right.
are.
Yes, it does try to silence you.
Yeah, and so he would always like hearing what I was still going to be able to be working on.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't hear that much anymore because mm-hmm. I did sever the connection just structurally. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
needed to. But he was a hoot.
Yeah, he's good. So thank you so
yeah,
much.
Anyway, well, thank you. I'll eat some chocolate as I sit in traffic on the way home.
Yeah, did I? I don't know if I think I did.